This is an ABC podcast.
For years, art buyers have been told the same thing.
He was an internationally acclaimed artist
whose work is available in Australia through only one gallery.
His works were selling really well.
But workers start to notice something unusual.
He's not contactable by any means.
They couldn't find any presence of him online.
In Search of the Missing Artist, a new three-part series that investigates the strange business of making art. Search Background Briefing wherever you get your podcasts.
After direct talks between the US and Iran concluded with no agreement, the US president has raised the stakes by ordering a blockade of ships which visit Iranian ports, further damaging the flow of energy around the world and causing oil prices to jump. Meanwhile, finance firms are on notice that the latest model from artificial intelligence giant Anthropic, Claude Mythos Preview, could threaten their systems. Is global banking waking up in time to the threat of AI? Welcome to ABC Business Daily. I'm Carrington Clark.
And I'm the ABC News Business Editor, Michael Yander.
Michael, thanks for joining us. It's important to put a timestamp on this one because
it is every day now, Carrington.
It does seem to be a common issue for us, but there is another countdown clock in action put in place by Donald Trump. This one is towards the start of this US naval blockade. Originally, he said it was about the Strait of Hormuz. We got an update from American Central Command saying it was actually about ships, not only potentially the Strait of Hormuz, but ships that went to Iranian ports. So this, coupled with the Iranian blockade, effectively means a closure of that whole Gulf, which we know is so critical for the supply of the world's energy, oil, gas, also fertilizer, a lot of other key components for the global economy. We have already seen a reaction in energy markets, this spike in the oil price. Just how bad news is this from the US president, and what does it mean, do you think, for the global economy?
In absolute terms, by itself, this isn't the end of the world. We're talking maybe up to about 2 million barrels a day that was getting out mainly to China, which is the biggest customer of Iranian oil. But what it signals could be disastrous, because if Iran resists this US blockade of its ports by, for instance, trying to sink and maybe successfully sinking or damaging a US warship, killing or injuring US military personnel, perhaps by firing more missiles, drones, etc. across the region and further damaging oil and gas infrastructure, that's what markets are really worried about, the retaliation. And then we could see oil prices spike well above even the current 7 or 8% increase we've seen this morning. So it's not just the barrels of oil that are now being locked in from Iran, but it's the potential for this conflict to escalate into, you know, from the ceasefire into a hot war.
Donald Trump seems frustrated by these ceasefire talks that didn't seem to really go anywhere in Pakistan, led by the American Vice President J.D. Vance. They couldn't come to an agreement. Donald Trump says it's because Iran refused to say that they wouldn't try to get a nuclear weapon. Iran has a different take on how these negotiations went. But he seems very frustrated that this hasn't resulted in some sort of long-lasting agreement. I think you can also see, I mean, the genesis of this idea is also interesting to me. If you look at Donald Trump's postings on social media, he reposted something which was suggesting one of the cards left to play, to use Donald Trump's favorite parlance, was that they could blockade the strait, which he then seemed to take up as an idea. We then saw CENTCOM kind of adjust what he had announced. So this did seem to be being made up on the fly. Now, the timing is also interesting. Once again, it's been announced while the US market isn't trading. The blockade will come into effect, according to this timeline, just after the market starts trading in New York. It's going to be midnight Australian time, but 10 o'clock in New York. There is time for Donald Trump to back away from this plan. Do you think that's the likely outcome, given what we've seen in recent weeks?
I mean, who knows? I would have thought markets would be down a lot more this morning on the news of this blockade, because this obviously came out after Wall Street had closed on Friday US time. And it had been a very positive week last week on hopes that these peace talks would generate some form of agreement or at least a continued ceasefire. you'd think the destruction of that with this new announcement about the US blockade would have seen, I mean, it did see oil prices up 8%, but we're seeing Australia down about 0.5% in the morning trade. Even Tokyo, which has been quite volatile in response to changes in the oil market.
Because they are so reliant on importing oil. Yeah.
From the Middle East. That was only down about 0.6%, 0.7%, 0.8% in very early trade there. So the market perhaps is taking the view that Donald Trump does keep backing down, and this time they're not going to be sucked in and they're just going to wait it out and see what happens. But as I said, if it does all blow up, things could change very quickly because, you know, what markets had been betting on is a short closure of the strait and then a return to energy normalcy within, you know, weeks, maybe months. The longer this goes on, we're seeing refineries running out of oil. They've chewed through their existing stockpiles. We are actually going to see the fuel shortages start hitting economies in the next 3, 4, 5 weeks. That's what all the experts are predicting. Then the global economy becomes a major issue. When you actually, it's not just the price, then you actually start running short of fuels that you need to keep things running.
Yes, the estimate is that around 100 to 105 million barrels of oil are used every day. This is from the International Energy Agency. As you say, it seems the best guess is about 2 million barrels were being taken from Iran into the global economy, mostly through China. India had also been a buyer, it seems. So 2%, maybe not that big a deal normally, but given that this may signify that there is going to be a prolonged blockade of that crucial part of the world for energy production, surely they need to take this seriously. But it also, one of the things that strikes me is that it's contrary to US administration policy, even in the just short span of this war, which was at one point they unsanctioned the Iranian oil that was floating around the world because there was such a dramatic spike in the price of oil. Now Donald Trump has done something that obviously is going to lead to higher oil prices. You can see perhaps why investors are betting that he's probably going to change his mind before it hurts US markets too much.
And that has been, you know, the constant taco bet that as soon as the economic pain becomes too much, particularly in the US domestically, with the midterms coming up at the end of the year, that Donald Trump will back down. I guess the fear that everyone either has or should have is that at some point maybe he won't. And then what do you do? Because the sell-off is going to be particularly brutal on that occasion when he doesn't taco.
One of the other things we need to be watching this week in the United States, in Washington, D.C., twice a year, the IMF and the World Bank brings together financial players for their spring and autumn meetings. The moment it's a spring meeting. So this is going to be central bankers from around the world, finance ministers, treasurers. They're going to be there talking about the state of the global economy. There's going to be a huge amount of attention on what's actually happening and what is forecast to happen. That, I think, is going to be building the political pressure on Donald Trump. Scott Bessent will be meeting with his contemporaries from around the world. That's the Treasury Secretary. You're going to be seeing central bankers meet. This is one of those points, I think, that perhaps it'll take control of the media cycle, and then Donald Trump will have to explain what his concept is for fixing this mess.
The problem is you're talking about the adults gathering in the room, and you know, this US blockade announcement sounds like something my six-year-old does when I say to her, if you do this, you can't
do that. Are you suggesting this might be a tantrum of some description?
It certainly has echoes of those kind of behaviours where you don't think through the consequences. You know, throw away my toy because I've thrown it at the wall, then, you know, I'm going to throw away something you own. You know, you blockade the waterway that I need to get oil out to the global economy, and I'm going to blockade your oil so you can't sell any. I mean, the thing that isn't clear here is how long the Iranian regime can exist without the revenues coming in from the oil. How much backing do they have from countries, for instance, like China, without the quid pro quo of oil? And Russia is a huge supporter of Iran, and in return for some of the, you know, drone supplies and other support Iran has been providing to the Russians, including in their conflict with Ukraine. I don't even know how well. I mean, Donald Trump has just spoken and said the Iranians are under immense pressure, and you know, but he said that before. They went into this war, according to New York Times reporting, you know, thinking that the Iranian regime possibly or even probably would collapse under the weight of the initial attacks, and that didn't happen. So if Iran can wait it out a lot longer than the US is expecting, you know, can the global economy survive that long without oil? You know, the 1/5 of oil that comes out of the Middle East through the Strait of Hormuz.
Yeah, and quite extraordinarily, Donald Trump is claiming that the US had not predicted that Iran would actually have the capability to close the Strait of Hormuz, which seems contrary to almost every expert who people were speaking to who said there was a real possibility that this would occur.
And had been why the US and Israel as well hadn't done this kind of thing for the past 3 decades, because that was the leverage Iran always had.
Let's turn to the Australian policy response to what's occurring. So we have seen the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, undertake these visits to Asia, the first one to Singapore, trying to shore up Australia's supply, particularly of refined fuel. He will also be visiting Malaysia, Brunei. What do you make of these attempts to shore up supply? And what does Australia need to achieve by actually doing it? Do we need something ironclad, or is it just helpful to be having these conversations?
I think having the conversations is a minimum, isn't it? You expect to see your prime minister or the foreign minister going to our major suppliers and trying to lock in what they can. Maybe those suppliers can't guarantee. I mean, Singapore is reliant on imported oil, most of it from the Middle East, to be able to refine it, to send it to us. Malaysia and Brunei do have crude oil production. So, and in fact, Brunei is the major supplier of the crude oil that Australian refineries turn into refined fuels, the two that remain open. So these are pretty critical talks, as well as shipping refined product to us. Whether we'll get a written ironclad guarantee, you know, they're in a pretty strong bargaining position. There'd be a lot of other countries scouring the world to find where they can get fuel supplies. And indeed, Australia's been doing that ourselves, where we're bringing in fuel from the Gulf of Mexico, from as far afield as the North Sea, places we'd never normally go because of the transport costs. But everything becomes much more economic now that fuel prices are so high.
What has been interesting is the government's position when it comes to using the leverage we might have as an exporter of energy, particularly of natural gas, in those negotiations. On one hand, I remember the Energy Minister, Chris Bowen, kind of hinted at that position when early on in the crisis, we were talking about how we're going to ensure that we continue to see a supply of refined fuel. And he said, well, we're going to be talking about trade both ways. We've been careful to not directly suggest that perhaps we could turn off the tap of our liquefied natural gas export if it was cut off. But it is kind of there, isn't it? That threat remains in the ether, even if it's not explicit.
It does, and it would be a massive departure from Australia to do that, because the government does not intervene in our commodity exports as a general rule. Like, we've been shipping iron ore to China as a free market trade, even if the customer is not a free market economy. Likewise, with liquefied natural gas, those are big multinational consortiums that own those plants that process that gas and export it into Asia. They're all on commercial contracts, mostly long term, and it would be a massive shift in policy for the government to override those long term contracts and force the gas suppliers to keep the gas in the ground or not send it offshore, basically as a bargaining chip to get liquid fuels into Australia. For context, the government hasn't even sought to impose additional taxes or domestic fuel reservations, for instance, on the East Coast, because that has been argued that that would be retrospectively interfering with commercial decisions and contracts that had been entered into already, even though the domestic manufacturing industry has been screaming out for a domestic gas reservation on the East Coast for years to offset the internationally linked higher prices that they've been suffering under. So it would be a massive step for the government to do that. And I think that's why they've been treading very carefully about the language.
What do you make of the other government responses? There's this advertising campaign that's going to kick into gear. The government, on one hand, has been trying to assure people that we still have long-term contracts in place to ensure that we continue to see the delivery of fuel and that those contracts go out. I think current estimates are now end of May. Then people start to be a little bit more concerned. Well, what does that mean for June? But what do you think about the multifaceted response we're now seeing from the government? And is it going to work to A, assure people that we have the supplies, and B, make sure we actually do have the supplies?
Yeah, well, they've been putting a lot of money on the table to back up these talks about bringing in extra fuel supplies and locking in additional contracts where there is availability. I think that's quite effective. But in terms of ad campaigns to try and get people to use less fuel, well, if you wanted to do that, you shouldn't have cut the excise on fuel, because any economist will tell you that price signals are as if not more effective than any advertising campaign. Also, there's a big debate about whether they've really missed the direction of where they should have gone. You know, cutting the excise on petrol prices and getting consumers to do, you know, fuel saving or not working from home and using public transport, that's great, but it's not actually unleaded petrol where the big economic problems lie. It is entirely in diesel. And we've already seen the diesel price rise back above pre-excise cut levels, because the diesel shortage globally is much more acute. To use some economist jargon you'd be familiar with, it's inelastic demand. You can't just stop using diesel. If you're a commuter with a petrol car, you can decide to catch the train to work. If you're a truck driver, if you decide not to drive your truck to save diesel, well, you're not doing any work. And it's the same for most users of diesel. And arguably, what the government should have done is cut the excise on diesel much more, perhaps to zero, and left the excise as it was on unleaded petrol. And there's quite a few experts suggesting this, because also the inflation pass-through from rising diesel costs is much more significant. The flow-through from petrol prices is actually a destruction of demand from consumers, because it mainly affects households. The rising diesel prices are already being put through into fuel surcharges and increased prices on a range of transported consumer items and business items for the building sector as well. So diesel is the problem, not petrol.
I mean, you've articulately argued the case for that issue. I wonder if politicians consider it to be too difficult a lift to kind of convince Australians who are facing higher prices every time they go to fill up. But if they can link it directly to, this is going to flow through to higher grocery prices, it's going to flow through to all the other costs of living, perhaps that is an argument that would be accepted.
Well, the petrol price excise cut is all about retail politics of, we're helping you out with your cost of living. But the real economic benefit comes if you can keep a cap on diesel prices, and that will then keep a cap on that second order inflation that the Reserve Bank's really worried about. So from an economics point of view, I think most analysts would agree that if you were going to cut excise, would have been much better to focus the cuts on diesel and the commercial sector and leave motorists to reduce their demand as they can.
I want to touch on another story that I think is very important to the stability of the global financial system. Again, the war has kind of displaced a lot of the other conversations we would probably be having right now, but this is one that I think people do need to be paying attention to, and one that I'm sure we'll be returning to. So Anthropic, which is one of the big artificial intelligence companies, one of the giants, and it likes to differentiate itself from some of its competitors by saying it's more ethical in the way it thinks that artificial intelligence should be deployed, has got its new model, Mythos Preview, Claude Mythos Preview. Now, instead of doing a general release to the public, instead what it did was gave the release to a group of different companies, including competitors like Google, also Apple, Microsoft, in order for them to use the model to test their own vulnerabilities, because this model was found to be extraordinarily effective at finding vulnerabilities within systems, operating systems, web browsers. And the concern was that if this fell into the hands of bad actors, that it could really go after those security issues and cause chaos. Now, we saw last week the Treasury Secretary in the United States, Scott Bessent, bring together leading financial figures, Bank of America, Citi, and to talk through the vulnerabilities of the global financial system. I mean, the global financial system is
but
built
it's all
on
online.
It's yeah, it's but this is obviously critical to everyone's living standards. It's digitally based now, and the idea that AI could potentially imperil to target particularly the financial system is a real prospect. And it's not a fear about the future. It does appear that perhaps this is a moment when it has arrived in a real way. What is your take?
Yeah, as some experts in the cybersecurity field have put it, we've crossed the Rubicon, where you've got an AI system that is finding errors. I think one of the examples was a source code error in Linux that had been there for 27 years that no hackers had yet discovered.
No human had been able to identify this, and it is able to do it in moments.
Yes, and if this gets into the hand of hackers or even, you know, knowledgeable lay people, it could absolutely destroy the cybersecurity of systems. And, you know, this is a problem with cloud computing. We've put everything on these big shared databases, and the only thing protecting that information and securing it and stopping it even being erased or locked up is, you know, code, is cryptography. And if there are coding errors that can be exploited to lock up this information, to corrupt it, to delete it, I mean, that could cause absolute chaos, because it's not like we've got physical backups of a lot of this data. So what happens if someone gets into the, you know, code of your bank and manages to scramble all the databases with the account details? Suddenly your account balance reads zero and the bank's struggling to, you know, recover all the information that's been locked or deleted or corrupted. It's a real concern. It's one the Reserve Bank and the Council of Financial Regulators in Australia have been concerned about for a number of years. But I think what this is telling us is those concerns need to be accelerated. As Alastair McGibbon, who used to be the cybersecurity guru in Australia for the Australian government, put it, you know, this is something people need to be meeting this week to start making crisis plans and check whether their systems are vulnerable.
I think that's exactly right. And yes, crossing the Rubicon is probably the analogy for this. These big artificial intelligence companies always say that part of the reason they need to be making these technological leaps is because you don't want a bad actor being the one who is doing them. But even when Anthropic is being, it seems quite transparent about the leaps that they are making, it's still unsettling to see how quickly these leaps are now apparently occurring, how vulnerable the systems are, and whether or not we do, as you say, potentially need a rethink of exactly where this information is being held and what safeguards are in place. I think this will, we talk about the spring meetings happening in Washington, D.C. among global financial elites and policymakers. I'm sure this will be item two on that list because, yes, the war is a clear and present danger to energy markets and, of course, global security. But the artificial intelligence revolution is going to have a lasting impact and potentially is as big a risk to the global financial system as this war and this energy crisis.
And as you point out, Carrington, the real fear here is that if Anthropic has done this now, it may be a matter of months until developers in China, perhaps even Russia, come up with the same kind of artificial intelligence coding, particularly around hacking. And there's always the danger the Anthropic code leaks out. I mean, they've given it to a very small select group of, I think it's about 40 organizations to test out. But, you know, once this gets out of the bag, you can't put it back in.
Yeah, absolutely. Michael, that is all the time we have for today's episode. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Carrington.
That is it for ABC Business Daily. We'll be back with another episode tomorrow. And in case you missed it, if you jump back in the feed, you'll see our first episode of Fuelcast. An additional ep you'll get in the ABC Business Daily feed every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. I'll be joined by Alan Kohler and Ian Verinder to bring you the latest on the global energy crisis specifically. That's alongside our regular episodes of ABC Business Daily. Make sure you're following us on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to send in a question on the fuel crisis or anything else we've discussed, potentially artificial intelligence and the threat to global financial systems, you can email abcbusinessdaily@abc.net.au. Catch you next time, Michael.
See you, Carrington.